Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Friday, April 30th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Greer.
And I'm Noelle Swan.
It's an American mystery. Why didn't the census count more people? Yes, the once every decade U.S. headcount released earlier this week showed that the resident population of the country did increase. As of April 2020, it's up 7.4% from 2010 to 331,449,281 people. But that's the slowest rate of growth since the 1930s, when America was battered by the Great Depression. And some of the states that the Census Bureau had predicted would grow the fastest, Arizona, Texas, and Florida, didn't do as well as expected. Arizona didn't get a new House seat, as predicted. Texas and Florida both got one less new member of Congress than they had planned on. These states all have significant Latino populations. Latino politicians and activists worry that none of them tried hard enough to get Latinos counted. Arturo Vargas, CEO of the Nalio Educational Fund, an organization of Latino officials, said in a statement, "There appears to be a correlation between the investment of statewide governmental resources in census outreach and apportionment tallies." Immigration also slowed in the months prior to the count. It is possible some unauthorized immigrants in the U.S. were deterred from filling out a census form because of the Trump administration's failed attempt to add a question about citizenship. The Census Bureau will release more detailed state and racial population data in September, which could yet shake up results. At stake is the speed of American transformation as people, money, and political power are shifting from the East and Midwest to Southern and Western states. Now, today's stories. Our first story. Populist leaders swept to power in recent years on a wave of promises. But confronted by a public health emergency like COVID-19, they have performed significantly worse than traditional politicians.
The five countries at the top of the global COVID-19 mortality tables, the United States, Brazil, India, Mexico, and Britain, have something in common. All had populist leaders when the pandemic began. Like Donald Trump, heads of the other four governments also played down the importance of the pandemic or moved slowly to deal with it. They shared some habits, too, oversimplifying the pandemic, dramatizing their own responses, asserting their own solutions, and forging divisions along the way. The results were catastrophic. And that has had political repercussions, even though they tried to shift the blame onto others. Mr. Trump is widely thought to have lost the U.S. presidential election because of his mishandling of COVID-19. Anger at Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is on the rise. In Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro's popularity is plummeting. Populist leaders such as Mr. Bolsonaro have deployed fake news and pseudoscience in a bid to contain the bitter fallout from his policies. In India, the government has ordered Twitter to delete posts critical of Mr. Modi's handling of the pandemic. But even some of Mr. Modi's supporters are disillusioned. Things are so bad now that when I talk politics with someone, I cannot support his policies and leadership, says Bijit Sarma, a tea planter in northeastern India. What would I even say? This story was reported by Sarita Santoshini in New Delhi, Anna Yanova in Rio de Janeiro, and Sarah Miller-Yana in Toronto for The Monitor.
The Saudi-Iran rivalry that has shaped the Middle East may be moving from a not-so-cold war of proxy battles to a cool peace where cooperation is possible. The region stands to benefit.
6 years ago, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his father, King Salman, shifted traditionally cautious Saudi Arabia to an aggressive foreign policy confronting Iran and its proxies, including, crucially, in neighboring Yemen. But in an interview on Saudi state TV this week, Prince Mohammed called for the two nations to overcome differences that have divided the region. He said, "We do not want Iran's situation to be difficult. On the contrary, we want Iran to grow and prosper." Some say the stark change in tone reeks of Saudi desperation to wind down its military entanglements. Others call it a shrewd reading of the Biden administration's diplomatic engagement with Iran. F. Gregory Gause, head of the International Affairs Department at Texas A&M University, says, "It didn't win in Yemen, it didn't win in Syria, didn't win in Lebanon. The failure of this more confrontational policy is probably leading to some rethinking in Riyadh. But the new U.S. administration's outreach to Iran is a driving factor." But the conciliatory tone and talks also signal something deeper, an understanding that the two rivals can exist side by side, even if they don't agree. It is an understanding that could improve lives in the region. This story was reported by Taylor Luck in Amman, Jordan, for The Monitor.
President Joe Biden has proposed expansive new federal spending to address climate change. But at a recent summit, a parallel emphasis was on something at least as important: mobilizing private sector investment on the issue.
At President Joe Biden's Leaders Summit on Climate last week, one constituency was a group somewhat new to the green spotlight: financiers. Banks and investors made some big dollar pledges. Bill Gates on plans to rapidly commercialize clean technologies, dozens of banks in a new net zero banking alliance, and more. It's encouraging, say climate policy experts, because it is necessary for there to be any hope of limiting the world's temperature rise to below 2 degrees Celsius, the global warming target set out in the 2015 Paris Agreement. Next comes the vital step of following pledges with actions. But those who track corporate climate actions add that the moves aren't happening on a whim. Instead, a combination of factors is altering business models, ranging from new analysis of climate risks to rising optimism about profits from climate-related investment. "The view that investors take is pretty straightforward," says Sasha Mackler, director of the Energy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington. "They will deploy their capital into projects that provide them a return. It's like gravity. Water flows downhill. Capital flows into projects that provide a return." This story was reported by Stephanie Haynes for The Monitor.
With something as complex as police reform and little change in the number of police killings, it can be hard to tell if progress is taking place. A closer look suggests it is.
Last year's protests against police brutality spurred a nationwide push to reform law enforcement. Dozens of states and cities responded, with bills curtailing aggressive police tactics and adding measures to ensure accountability. Maryland and New Jersey, in particular, changed use of force policy at its foundation. But if changing a decentralized and complicated institution is difficult, evaluating those reforms is almost more so. While not the only measure of law enforcement quality, the number of police killings last year remained a stable 1,000 per year, or about 3 per day. This year's numbers fit that pattern so far. Still, that doesn't mean the responses aren't working, says Seth Stoughton, a professor of criminal justice at the University of South Carolina School of Law. With just under 18,000 police departments across the country, policing is extremely complex. Standards vary based on locale, as do the laws enforced. Given the scope of required corrections, it's highly unrealistic to expect any one piece of legislation to fundamentally fix these very complicated, often extra-legal problems, says Professor Stoughton, who recently published a book on police use of force. Instead, he says, citizens should advocate for further legislation while accepting that sustained incremental solutions, which take time, are often the most effective. Such a process may already be at work, says Stephen Rushen, professor of criminal law at Loyola University Chicago School of Law. The last year has seen some pretty transformative legislation passed in states across the country, he says. I think those are significant steps that we have rarely seen historically in the past. This story was reported by Noah Robertson, with graphics by Jake Turcotte for The Monitor.
Many have discovered the restorative properties of outdoor recreation. This essayist tells of how working with nature has often refreshed her as well.
I have never meditated by conscious choice. It just happens sometimes, writes Sue. My mind goes utterly quiet, inviting new fill. In my days as a dairy farmer, it often happened as I milked the cows or sat on my tractor. I would lose any semblance of thinking beyond the contours of the animals, the undulating fields. When the milk tank filled or that final middle row of fragrant dried meadow grass curled into form behind me, I'd wake as if from a curative sleep, ready for the world of ideas, anxieties, anticipations, and plans. Today, Sue writes, I'm half a world away in Switzerland. Recently, I went on a 3-hour hike along a karst valley replete with waterfalls, caves, and archaeological sites. I simply put one foot in front of the other, listened to the rippling and cascading water, and peered into the dark, blank mouths of trailside caves. There's a lot to be said for not tuning in to the past or future for stretches of time, for dwelling only in the flank, the windrow, or the footfall, whatever the moment presents. I cannot turn off my mind, but sometimes it so fills with the here and now, there's no room for more. You can read Sue Wunder's full first-person essay in today's edition.
Now, commentary from the Monitor's editorial board on democracy's invisible armor against bullies. During his early months in office, President Joe Biden has taken an unusual approach to the four countries that the United States considers to be the world's biggest bullies: Iran, China, Russia, and North Korea. While he talked or acted tough toward each, like previous U.S. presidents, Mr. Biden also took an important affirmative step. He shored up the four countries that are aggrieved neighbors of those respective bullies: Iraq, Taiwan, Ukraine, and South Korea. He especially sought to make sure the democratic credentials of those four remain strong, part of their critical defense against the autocratic aggressor next door. Mr. Biden's boldest move was to send senior U.S. statesmen to Taiwan. In a call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Mr. Biden not only gave unwavering support to Ukraine against the latest Russian military aggression, he also pushed for more domestic reforms. He talked at length with Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi, commending his leadership in the delicate balancing of political factions. Democratic ideals, such as equality before the law, may not seem like an effective defense against bullets and ships. Yet sometimes the best armor against bullies is invisible. It also sometimes needs shoring up. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thanks for joining us today. Come back Monday when we'll preview a big Supreme Court case looking at disparities in drug conviction sentencing. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares how seeing her mother's spiritual identity brought a conviction that good can never be lost, even when someone passes away. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton and Erica Page.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2021.